President, let's start off. When you were addressing the 67th section of the UN General Assembly in New York, you stated, and I quote, our youth are not only our future, we are also our present, unquote. This includes the Ghanaian youth for that matter. Has the Ghanaian youth been equipped enough to take charge of the present, you as the president?
Yeah, I made that statement based on the fact that if you look at our population and demographic, Ghana can be said to be a very youthful nation.
Yeah.
And it's a trend that is taking place in the whole of Africa. And so you cannot say that a segment of your population that is in the majority, you know, owns the future when they live in the present. And that was the context in which I said that. But let me say that opportunities for youth are growing wider every day. I mean, if I take when I went to school, I guess that Ghana's school enrollment was below 50%. And for girls, it was even worse. Less than 30% of girls went to school at the time that I started school. Today, under the Millennium Development Goals, we've achieved almost 99% school enrollment. Almost all children who should be in school are in school. And those that are not out of school, we are mopping up with special programs to make sure they go to school. We've achieved gender parity with regards to school enrollment between boys and girls. As many boys are going to school as girls. And indeed, the girls are threatening to overhaul the boys when it comes to education. And if you look at tertiary education, in the time that I was in school, less than 10% of us who started primary school ended up in tertiary education. Others, you know, left the school at different levels of the educational ladder. But today, if you add the private universities and the public universities, you add all the polytechnics, you add the colleges of education and all that, the number of young people leaving secondary school and continuing to tertiary education is phenomenal. And so more opportunities exist today than ever before to equip our youth to be prepared for life. Aside from that, the whole ICT revolution gives them access to knowledge that we could not have dreamt of when we were children. I mean, when we were children, if you wanted to gain knowledge, you had to read a book, you had to go to the library, borrow a book, read it, send it back, borrow another book. I mean, today my kids have tablets, they are, you know, prolific on the internet, they can access any knowledge anywhere in the world. And so I think that increasingly our youth are more equipped than we were to face life.
So basically you're using education to measure this?
I'm using education. Education is the most precious possession that prepares you for life. And so when you say equipped, are youth more equipped, then I use it in the context of their ability to gain knowledge. And I think that now than ever before, the young people have the opportunity to gain knowledge than in times past.
Well, unfortunately, one big challenge that most young people are going through has got to do with unemployment. It's not only one special case here in Ghana. It's a global issue. But that of Ghana is one thing that we've been struggling to solve for some time now. What strides have we made so far to see how best we can solve the unemployment rate in this country? In Ghana, we even have graduate unemployment. Since you talked about education, these are students from the tertiary level who should be equipped.
To break it down, I think that first and foremost, the natural process of job creation is contained in the growth of the economy. As the economy grows, it creates the opportunity for jobs to be thrown out. And so one of the major priorities that we should be looking at is growing the economy. And so we want to accelerate the economy so that more people can find jobs, both in the formal and informal sectors. Aside from that, promoting private sector development, especially in the small and medium enterprises. And the government had been like the major employer. Everybody left school and thought that government should employ them. But unfortunately, there's a limit to how many government can employ. And so the private sector has to begin to grow to be able to take up the extra, you know, jobs that are needed to be created in order that we can offer employment to our people, and especially in the small and medium enterprise sector. And that is why government is issuing incentives to the small and medium enterprises, providing support to small and medium enterprises in order that they can expand their enterprises and be able to take in more people. Aside from that, I think that it is also based on a misalignment of what skills industry and the world of work are looking for. I've said this a few times before, that we are training more people in the humanities. For example, if you go to many of our schools, there are a lot of young people doing marketing. And there could be a saturation in employment when it comes to marketing. So you might be a graduate, you might have a marketing degree, but you can't find a job because there are more people being trained in marketing than there are jobs in marketing. And so we did a summit with industry. It was organized by the Ministry of Education to between academia and industry, see how we can tailor the curriculum to create graduates in the areas that industry is looking for. Industry is looking for technical people. They're looking for technicians. They're looking for engineers. But are we creating enough engineers? Are we creating enough of the people that industry is looking for? And so that summit took place. I hear it was a very fruitful. I opened it. Mm-hmm. It was a very fruitful summit. And we're waiting for the Ministry of Education to present the report.
When was the summit here?
It was held at the end of last year.
At the end of last year?
End of last year, yeah.
Okay. Wouldn't you say it's been that long to get the report submitted to you if you don't want to tackle the issue?
I would think that it's quite an enormous a job to do. And so I think that they are synthesizing the report. And then when we see it, we would see what we need to do is to see how universities and tertiary educational institutions can skew, you know, enrollment into tertiary school to be able to create more of the kinds of people that industry is looking for. But one of the things we need to look at too is that for most of the countries that have developed, the skills training and empowerment in terms of job creation has been in the middle level sector, that is at the polytechnic level and the vocational and technical level. And so if you take Germany for example, I mean practical courses in polytechnics and things have been the favorite option. Unfortunately in Ghana, I don't know if it's a British colonial inheritance, we revere degrees more, PhDs and masters and things more than hands-on practical education. Now if you look at industry is in most cases looking for hands-on practical education, but everybody wants their children to go to university and have a PhD and do a more theoretical, you know, academic degree than to do hands-on practical education. And so that's part of the misalignment that we have, and we need to work at it to make sure that we're creating more of what industry needs so that they can be readily employable. You see later today, we're even trying to encourage young people to become entrepreneurs, to take their destiny into their own hands and be able to set up businesses and also employ people. And later today I'm going to meet the first batch of awardees under the Youth Enterprise Support Fund. But there are several funds that, you know, are assisting young people. And there are young people who are taking advantage of opportunities and doing the best of it. I've seen young entrepreneurs, you know, who are doing fantastic. I was in Ashanti to launch the Cocoa Roach program. And when I went to Bekwai, you know, to launch the Roach program in Bekwai, the contractor was very young, you know, I guess he's barely about in his mid-30s or early 30s. You know, I've forgotten the company, Mabab Construction or something. And he's won the contract for Bekwai Town Roads. He's doing like 5 or 6 kilometers of Bekwai Town Roads. And I was impressed. You know, I think that young people should take advantage of any opportunities they have. I mean, you have young people in microfinance, Mykinaku, Base Capital. I mean, there's so many of them. I meet them all along the way. And I think that while government creates the opportunity, it is our responsibility as young people to also take advantage of the opportunities that are are thrown away.
You addressed the youth in Benin when you visited the president in Benin, and as part of solving Ghana's unemployment challenges, you mentioned the first thing that you just talked about here is the growth of the economy. And one thing that you said was that in Ghana, you try as much as possible not to go below 8% in terms of economic growth. But as we speak now, we are really, really below that. So that means that we've not done that well in that area when it comes to the growth of the economy. That can even help us solve the unemployment situation in this country. That's the young ones are going.
We need to smoothen out the path, you know, and that's what we're working on. And that's why we need a certain fiscal discipline to ensure that the economy is put back on track and is growing quite well. But I'm sure we'll discuss issues of the economy much later. But averagely, Ghana's economy has been growing averagely at about 7%. And we need to accelerate that. In 2011, the first year of oil production, we went as high as 14%.
Yeah.
But that was an extraordinary spike. What we need is an average growth rate that is above 8% consistently over a period so that we can overtake the rate of population growth. Because as you have a high rate of population growth and you have a high number of young people coming up, you must have a rate of economic growth that is above population growth in order that you can consistently be churning out jobs for them. And so we're working on the economic issues, and when we come to that, I'll specify more about that.
Let's quickly focus on the informal sector, which you talked about earlier. The International Labour Organization estimated that about 93% of jobs available to the young people in developed countries, including Ghana, also are in the informal sector, which where the earnings are low, working conditions are unsafe, and there's a little or no access to social protection. In this regard, for us in this country, what have we done, or what has been done to expand the opportunities in the informal sector and also address the challenges of the informal economy, at least to boost these young people who are willing to move into that area?
What we need to do is to transition much of the informal sector to the formal sector so that you can reach that sector with the support that is required. The transition is taking place, but it's taking place rather slowly. We need to accelerate the pace at which the informal
taking
sector...
slowly because...
It's taking place slowly because of the environment in which we are operating. Let me tackle it from this angle. I believe that we should start with an integrated population registration system, an IPRS, where we're able to identify our citizens. We're able to name our streets, number our houses, register our businesses, know where every business is, however small it is, and what business that is. Have a linkage between all these, an IPRS, business registration, our tax identification number. Have it linked with our driver's licenses, linked with our Ghana Revenue Authority, linked with health insurance and all that. When you've done that, it makes it easy for you to identify your people and what they are doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it helps you to reach the informal sector and gradually graduate them into the formal sector. For instance, we don't have a database of taxi drivers or commercial drivers. How do you support commercial drivers? It's a shot in the dark. We bring taxis and say, we want people to come and take taxis and work and pay. It's even difficult to know where the person you want to help with the taxi lives, so that you can monitor and make sure that they pay gradually, and over time you revolve it and help somebody else. And so the lack of a proper database of who our people are and where they are and what they are doing is part of the difficulty in being able to transition the informal sector into the formal sector. But I think that as the informal sector expands and we're able to support it, then it will allow it to grow and be able to create more jobs. There is some reluctance on the part of some of the informal operators to come out, but they don't realize that if you move into the formal sector, the transparency of the way you operate helps you to grow your business. Somebody might say, well, if I register my business and all that, government will take tax from me. But if all of us registered our business, then it means that the tax burden will be lighter on all of us. And so there are many things that we can do together. With regards to the IPRS, steps are being taken already to establish an integrated population registration system. Most of the district assemblies have started with street naming.
Okay.
We need to go the next step to do the house numbering and then to have a GPS that allows us to know what all those properties are and be able to tell where every single business business in this country is have a database of who fishermen are. If we want to support fishermen, we don't have a database of fishermen. And these are things that we need to establish to be able to reach out to people.
The thinking is that we have institutions that can really handle most of these things that you're talking about in terms of data collection and recognizing these people in the informal sector. The question is, what are these institutions been doing all this well?
What is happening is they are doing it, but they are all doing it in their own autonomous manner. What I'm talking about is a linkage and a coordination. You have one agency doing its own database and registering its own people. You have another one doing its own. What we need is a linkage and a coordination amongst these. And that's why I charged the National Information Technology Agency to be the supervisory organization that ensures that the databases that we're putting together are able to communicate with each other. You have DVLA having a database, you have SNIT having a database, you have National Health Insurance having a database, you have Electoral Commission having a database. Everybody has a database, and these databases are autonomous and do not talk to each other. We're setting up a national data center currently, and that national data center will host, you know, the databases of all these institutions and make sure that they communicate with each other.
Let's move straight into entrepreneurship. Recently, President Obama was in Kenya, and the whole drive and the whole idea was about entrepreneurship. Similar situation to here in Ghana. But one big challenge that young entrepreneurs would talk about has got to do with access to capital to start their business. This is one big challenge for them. They are even having problems with even the banks, even secure loans. In that regard, what have you done? What initiatives have put in place to see how best we can really help the young ones to really assess the capital to move into entrepreneurship as a means of even solving this whole unemployment situation?
And that is a major mistake we make. When we want to go into business, mostly in Ghana, the first thing anybody thinks about is capital. Capital is not the first thing you should think about. The first thing is the idea. The second is to prepare yourself to go into that enterprise in terms of your training, your skill. Capital comes after these have been acquired.
Capital plays a key role.
It does. But most of the time we focus so much on capital without looking at whether the idea is feasible. I saw a beautiful, the last time I went to a dance, I saw somebody had built a beautiful wooden thing. And he says, afternoon tea here, restaurant, what? Of the business was, I mean, there's nobody going to go there, and there was nobody there. It was deserted, you know. So the idea was wrong. You can put in as much capital into that afternoon tea business, it won't fly. And the point even is, Ghanaians used to drinking afternoon tea. You know, so you can come to your uncle and get capital and go and do an afternoon tea business, and nobody will go to your establishment. And so often in Ghana, when we talk about a business, the first thing we talk about is capital, access to credit. But that is not the first thing. If you get as much credit as you want, you don't have an idea, you don't have the training to manage the business will collapse, and you come looking for credit again. Government has put humongous credit into our private sector. From the period of the PNDC, I remember the AGI and others were giving 40 million Ghana cedis or something. You know, all that money went into the private sector and disappeared. There were various funds that were set up to be put into the private sector. It's just capital. And have we talked about training, entrepreneurship? And that's the kind of thing we try to correct in the Youth Enterprise Support Program. Yeah.
Okay, and which today happens to be exactly 1 year since you launched that program, to see how best we can solve this problem. Is that the best avenue or the only avenue we can use to even get the young people moving into entrepreneurship by helping them with this support fund?
No, there are several others. Yes, it's just the flagship. I mean, it was a presidential initiative. And so, yes, we're launching today 107 grantees have been selected, and 2.7 million Ghana cedis is being given to them. This has been after a period of training. They've gone through training, they've gone through orientation, their business ideas have been vetted, they've walked through them to make sure they are feasible, and so the capital bit, which is granting the financing, is not at the beginning, it's rather at the right point in establishing the business. And so these grantees have been trained. We started with a seed fund of 10 million. They are disbursing 2.7 million. And they'll go on several rounds. They'll take more people in. And so I think that those who did not get selected in the first wave should not be discouraged. They should think through their business ideas again. And they can resubmit, you know, and walk through the process. And if they are selected, they'll be funded. But we have other programs like the Skills Development Fund, which is assisting young people who want to go into business, you know, to be able to set up their own businesses. For existing businesses, we have, you know, we're granting added support, you know, to people. The Skills Development Fund that I talked about has been disbursed to several beneficiaries like the Ghana National Association of Poultry Farmers, and then to people engaged in rice farming, Association of Electrical Contractors, and so many others who want to go into jewelry design and technology, you know, have been assisted. And so there are several such programs that we are engaged in.
Let's talk about the youth and ICT. Have we as a country taken advantage of this new explosion to really propel us into the next stage of technological development as a nation?
Yeah, I'm satisfied with the developments that are taking place in ICT. Having been a part of the initial liberalization of the telecom sector and the beginning of this whole ICT revolution, I look back and I'm very happy and amazed at how far we've come. Government is investing heavily to try to make sure that there's access across the country. Only 2 months ago, I was in Ho to launch the Eastern Corridor fiber cable, which is an 800-kilometer long fiber cable going through 26 districts and giving connectivity to all the 26 districts along that corridor, and in order that they can have high-speed internet access. We are designing and working on a Western Corridor cable access so that we're able to bring a lot of our people, you know, onto the ICT revolution. Ghana was adjudged a few years ago the fastest growing mobile broadband country in Africa, and wherever you go in the country, you have fairly decent access to internet. I mean, when I travel across the country with my phone, I'm able to access the internet, my email, you know, able to use the WhatsApp application, use Snapchat, you know, I mean, it makes it easy to access. And I think that a lot of our young people are taking to it. But in order to create more jobs, we are investing in setting up a business processing outsourcing center, which is in an advanced stage, and when it's finished, it will create the opportunity for business processing to take place. We anticipate that it will employ about 10,000 young people when it is operational, and so that's one of the investments that government is making. There are other young people who are into software producing various applications. I mean, there are so many applications that are being produced. My favorite, the recent one that I came across is the Hey Julo app. It's an emergency alert app, you know, and the naming alone is quite interesting. But there are very many other applications. Smec Labs allows you to select your favorite meal from any restaurant, you know, in Accra. You know, that you, if you want to eat fufu or whatever, you know which restaurant to get it from. You have MapTech, which allows you, using GIS, to be able to manage your logistics and supply chain. I mean, there's so many of them. Green Life, you know, allows you to develop interactive platforms with business entities. Akechia, you know, is a payroll application that many of our Ghanaian enterprises are using. So I think that the growth of ICT is fairly satisfactory.
You're very active on social media. Do you get the sense that young people in this country are using the social media the right way?
Majority of them are using it to access information, to participate in government, you know, and generally to keep correspondence and communication with their peers, you know. but there are few people misusing it in terms of posting, you know, content that is not acceptable. Sometimes pornography, you know, and sometimes people take the anonymity of social media as a license to make the most outrageous statements or concoct things about people and all that. But we cannot use that to say that it's not, you know, something that is advantageous to our young people. I use it to sound out, you know, what young people are thinking or what the population is thinking. And so I'm active on Facebook, on Twitter, you know, and I receive a lot of messages, and I think it's useful for a leader to be able to have that access.
When you receive those messages, do you reply to them?
When I have time. There are times when I'm personally behind it, and then if I put JM behind, then it means it's me communicating. But normally we'll have administrators. If there's something that is interesting, they'll bring it to my attention, and then I give them what my point of view is, and they would respond. But when I have time, sometimes on the weekends, and I'm just, you know, browsing, I do it myself, and I communicate with people.
If you just join us, you're listening to Unique 95.7 MHz of the Ghana Broadcasting Corporation. We are transmitting live from the residence of the President of Ghana, His Excellency John Dramani Mahama. Today is International Youth Day, and we're joining here at his residence to talk about issues concerning the youth and other national-related issues too, and other national-related issues too. We're also live across the 10 regions of Ghana. We are live on GBC regional FM stations, and you can send us a WhatsApp message if there's a question you wish the President to really address. 0243-343573. My name is George. Let's quickly move to your agenda for transformation for Ghana between 2014 and 2020, which you presented in your 2014 State of Nation address. By way of evaluation, what has been done so far in attainment of that agenda?
We're required to present the vision to Parliament before the end of my second year in office, and the NDPC did quite some work on it and did a lot of consultation, and so it was presented to Parliament at the end of last year. It's for 2014 to 2020, and the focus of the agenda for transformation is to transform the structure of our economy, like I said in the State of the Nation address, to move it from a raw material based, export based economy to one that is more manufacturing and value addition oriented, and then also to reduce the level of our import dependency. That is the major thrust of the agenda for transformation. And so import substitution is a major part of it. Adding value to our exports is another major part, and then diversifying our exports is one of them, and attracting more manufacturing industries in. And so we've been activating that over the last 1.5 years or more. One, in terms of to entrepreneurs in strategic sectors. One of the strategic sectors we chose is pharmaceuticals, and we have this best about 50 million Ghana cedis, I think, so far, to pharmaceutical enterprises to be able to retool and expand their several of the companies of N. At the beginning of this year, I did a tour of their businesses, and many of them have put in new equipment and expanded their production. For instance, we're producing a lot of the antiretrovirals for HIV patients locally now than we used to do before. Before, we used to import most of the antiretrovirals. Today, we're producing most of them locally. And so that's just one example. There are many other examples. A week ago, I went and opened the factory for Convivaria, and they are packaging tomato paste for the local market, and they're doing 25,000 metric tons so far. Ghana's total consumption is 100,000 metric tons. They are doing 25,000 metric tons. They are starting their phase two expansion, which would add another 25,000 metric tons. So they alone will be producing about half the national requirements of tomato paste. And what they're doing is integrating the tomato paste production backwards into our economy by encouraging the growing of tomatoes so that they can source the tomatoes locally to produce the tomato paste. So it's a good beginning. So 3 months ago, I inaugurated Tuton Cocoa Processing Company that is producing, is processing our cocoa for export. And currently we are at 28% processing of cocoa for exports. And then we export the remainder as raw beans. We want to increase that to 50%. And so we're encouraging more companies to go into cocoa processing so that we're able to add value. We have given support to rice farming, and so we're seeing an increase in rice production. We saw a 60% jump in rice production. We saw a drop of rice imports in 2014 of about $192 million. That is progress that is being made. We're investing in the Comenda Sugar Factory so that when it starts, it can begin to produce sugar locally so that we can save on the $300 million that we use to import sugar every year. These are physical things that we're doing that are visible and tangible that people, you know, can see. We're giving support to local poultry producers to expand their amount of poultry, and we're asking importers to buy 40% of their import volume locally, so that the local producers have a market. And so there are a lot of visible things that we're doing.
Since we talked about the NDPC and what they did within the transformation agenda for 2014, between 2014 and 2020, recently they launched the national development, they launched the process of getting a national development plan. You support the idea that this plan should be binding on political parties and society governments?
Not in the sense of legislating it, you know, but in the sense of the inclusiveness of the process, we should all sign up to it when it's been done. And all of us must agree that this is the vision we want to pursue. I said that one of the major characteristics of the long-term development plan is it must have a flexibility to accommodate political and ideological orientation, because a party might be left of center, a party might be right of center. And so there must be that flexibility so that whichever government is in power can fine-tune the
long term. But that doesn't distort the whole idea.
No, it won't. It won't. As long as the objectives are the same. As long as the objectives are the same and we agree that this is where we want our country to be in the next 40 years, I believe that within it we can have little tweaking that suits our own ideological orientation. I think so.
But can we build a national development plan based on ideology?
We can build a national development plan based on consensus,
but not on ideologies.
Well, we have varied ideologies and thinking, and so you cannot have, you can't build a long-term development plan based on socialism, because there are people who don't believe in a socialist system. Yeah, but I'm saying that it should be a long-term development plan based on Ghana, and what we want as Ghanaian people, what we want our country to be in 40 years. And once we've achieved that consensus within it, whether we're socialist or we're capitalist or we're left-leaning or we're right-leaning, you know, we can work towards achieving the same goal.
So you're saying that the framework shouldn't change, but the process attaining to the framework.
The raw framework, I think, shouldn't change, but within the framework, we can make adjustments to accommodate each other as we go forward.
Let's talk about now to the growth of the economy. And we are now with the IMF and seeing how best we can restructure the whole economy for us. Would you agree that we have not managed the economy well? That's going through these challenges and even going to the IMF?
I wouldn't say exactly so. I mean, Ghana has had a, you know, cyclical boom and bust kind of, you know. There are times when you have strong economic growth, you have things going well, then it declines. And it's partly because of several factors. One, it's partly because our economy is commodity-based, and so we cannot help but be affected by what happens on the commodity market. And that is what the agenda for transformation seeks to change, to ensure that we diversify the economy, to ensure that we add more value to our exports, and to ensure that we reduce our dependency on imports in order that we can have a more resilient economy so that we're not subject to the changes that take place on the global market. unfortunately, that we still are very much an import-dependent economy, and most of our exports are still very much primary resource-based. And so we cannot help but be affected by changes on the commodity market. Apart from that, we have this cyclical problem with the economy where often in the electoral cycle, I mean, especially when you're going into elections, you have a lot of pressure on government for projects, you know, and to fulfill promises and all the kinds of things. Then aside from that, you also have pressure from the labor front, you know, for improved conditions of service and all that. And normally, if you don't maintain the fiscal discipline to ensure that you implement the budget strictly, you find that by the end of the electoral cycle, you have overshot your deficit target. And that's what happened in 2012. In 2012, we were aiming at a fiscal deficit of 7.5%. We ended at 12%. And we have been doing the corrective measures since then till now. From 2013, 2014, we've been taking corrective measures to bring the macro economy back on track. Happily, it's beginning to show signs that we have an economic turnaround. We are on track after the first review of the with the IMF to hit 7.2%, even though our target is 7.5%. Just using first quarter numbers, we are on track for 7.2. We've reduced borrowing from the central bank from 10% to 5%, and so we're not over borrowing from the central bank. Fiscal tightening is taking place, and you can see that fiscal consolidation is on the way. We are seeing some stabilization in the CD, even though it's still finding its correct level. It went to the outside extreme of 4.5%, and then it came back down to another extreme of 3%. Now it's hovering between 3.5 and 3.7. You know, so I think that it's in the process of finding its true, you know, a stable level. We have seen a decline in inflation. Inflation, the rate of growth of inflation has started to decline. So even though it's going up by smaller margins, and we expect that by the end of the year, that will begin to drop. And if inflation starts to drop, then it will give way for interest rates to start coming down. So we're coming out of the woods. We are not there yet, I would say.
We're coming out because we are with the IMF?
No, because we're being more disciplined with government expenditure. We're working to increase revenues, and I think that is what is getting us out.
Why were we able to do all these things before moving to the IMF? Why were we not able to do all these things previously that could have been prevented from...
No, because there were many factors at play. One, we implemented the single spine salary scheme. It took our wage and compensation bill from 2.8 billion to 9 billion. All that money was money that went into some people's pockets, into our pockets. You get paid, and so it went into your pocket, you know. And we are paying the price. It doesn't take 1 year to turn things around. It takes some time. And we're a member of the IMF, and there's nothing wrong with us going to the IMF if we need, you know, some balance of payment support to be able to turn an economic situation around. And it's not the first time we're going to the IMF. I'm hoping it will be the last time, but it's not the first time. And so there are many factors that are accounted for, but I must say that we're seeing a turnaround. The first review was good. I've seen the second quarter figures. They are not out yet, but the second quarter figures look even much better than the first quarter figures. So I think fiscal consolidation is taking place, and it's taking place based on the homegrown policy that we came up with. It is that same policy we presented to the IMF and said, this is the policy we want to present. And then working together with the IMF, we have been implementing it. And so it's homegrown, it's not dictated by the fund.
So we are managing our own.
We are managing
not
it
the IMF.
No.
They are not telling us what
we are managing it ourselves. We are doing the reviews together. We've agreed on the benchmarks we want to attain. And we're doing the reviews together, and the reviews are showing that we're on the right track.
If we are managing our own affairs and our own, the economy ourselves, why the freeze on employment?
Because we want to bring the wages and compensations bill down. In 2013, wages and compensation for public sector workers consumed 73% of total tax revenues. 73% of total tax. All the taxes we collected, 73% was used to pay wages and salaries. And 27% was used for the remaining 25 million people. Public sector workers are about 600,000.
Yeah.
So it means that 73% of taxes went to 600,000 people in this country. And the remaining 26 million, the remaining 25.4 million people, you know, then benefit from 27%. That must, you know, pay for the expenses on the MDAs, it must go for maternal mortality, it must go for paying subsidies to secondary schools, it must go to providing teaching and learning materials in schools, 23% of tax revenues. And so we have been working to bring this down, and we're making progress. As I speak, we have brought wages and compensation from 2013 from 73% of tax revenues to 49% of tax revenues. And so there's more money being freed up to provide for the other segment of the population. There's more money being freed up to provide CHIPS compounds and to provide, you know, assistance to reduce maternal mortality and infant mortality and all that. And in any case, let me say, there's not a freeze on employment as such. That open license for anybody to employ has been taken away. You need to apply to the Ministry of Finance to be given permission to employ. And it must be in areas where strategically we believe that employment must take place. And so we're still employing doctors, we're still employing teachers. And so if they say there's a freeze on employment, it's not true. Doctors are being employed, teachers are being employed, nurses are being employed. But we're employing in the strategic areas where we still need manpower. In the areas where we don't need, yes, we're not employing.
Okay.
So that's the main reason.
Okay. Yeah. You've taken a very tough decision. Recently you came out saying that you're not going to approve of anything that is outside what you've budgeted for. Some economists will say that, well, we have to take these decisions because it's best for us as a country. But politicians will not agree because you might lose 2016. What response do you have for this?
I think that the time has come when we have to do what we have to do and not keep an eye on the political ball. This government has taken some of the toughest decisions in the history of our economy. We've deregulated petroleum products. In the past, I mean, government has had to contain huge subsidies on petroleum products, on electricity tariffs, and so on and so forth. But what happens is, are these tariffs, are these subsidies sustainable? We currently have deregulated petroleum products, and the benefit is going to the consumer. Petroleum prices are much lower than they were when government was setting them. And so that advantage is going to the consumer. The OMCs are currently in competition with each other in terms of setting their price, and I've seen the prices being undercut by each other so that the prices have come down. Unfortunately, in Ghana, when transport fares go up, transporters are reluctant to bring it back down. Otherwise, I mean, with the drop in petroleum prices, transport owners or transport operators should have been giving a benefit to the road user in terms of reduction in transport fares. Unfortunately, that hasn't happened. But for those who use their own vehicles and for governments, the cost of petroleum, you know, has come down. That is a benefit. We've taken some tough decisions in order that we can stabilize the economy and grow the economy. Because if we don't do that and we're not fiscally disciplined and we throw the economy out of sync again, we will come back to the same point and accuse government of mismanaging the economy, accuse government of not providing jobs because the economy is not growing. And so these are things that one has to do as a leader. I'm not wicked to take some of the decisions that I have to take. Where I sit, I see the issues that need to be dealt with. And I swore an oath to the people of Ghana to do my job, you know, in the best interest of the people of Ghana. And so I take those decisions. And people say, I mean, you're wicked. If I could give petrol free to all Ghanaians, or I could let everybody enjoy free electricity, I'll do that. But what would happen? GRA will crash. We will not be able to produce electricity for anybody. If tariffs are low, we are asking independent power producers to come in and produce power. They're not going to come and produce that power and give it to us for free. We're going to have to pay for it. And so if people are not paying for power, or if people are paying artificial prices for power, how do we pay the independent power producers? Today, all of us are fed up with Dumso. So we contracted emergency power. It's coming. The car power ship is coming. Ameri is coming. All of them. And we have to pay for that power. If we say we want to enjoy unrealistic prices, tariffs, how do we pay for that emergency power?
So we say we are prepared to face whatever political consequences this will bring to you.
The decisions that need to be taken. And I'm sure that Ghanaians are descending and will realize that those decisions are being taken in their best interest.
This morning, we have been told that Kolobu has closed down its outpatient department. 37 is calling for NADMO's help because your hospital's facilities have been overstretched. It's not got to do with the doctor's strike. You, as the president of Ghana, how do you feel when you sit back these past few weeks and you hear reports of people dying because there's no doctor to attend to them when they move to the public hospitals? You hear reports that police hospital, 37 military hospital, the facilities there are overstretched and all that. How do you feel as a president?
Nobody must die because of an illegal strike. The strike is illegal, absolutely illegal. Look at the factors. Doctors ask for conditions of service. Of course, all workers deserve conditions of service. It's not like it existed and we took it away. It's the first time it's being introduced. It takes a process of negotiation to put those conditions of service in place. Even before the negotiation has ended, the GMA has taken several months to draw up their conditions of service, and then they give it to government and say, here are our demands for conditions of service. We give you up to 29th. If you don't grant it, we're going on strike. And they start a strike. Even when negotiations are taking place, the labor law says that nobody should negotiate under duress. And that is what has led us to where we've always come back to. Somebody says, oh, doctors, just give it to them. But their linkages have come to learn in the whole relativity of our pay structure. Doctors are linked to health workers, and it's not in doctors alone who are in the business of giving health to people. You have the nurses, you have the midwives, you have the x-ray technicians, you have the laboratory technicians, you have the pharmacists, you even have the cleaners. When blood drops on the blood on the ground, that cleaner who takes the mop and knows how to disinfect it and clean it in a safe manner is contributing to healthcare. We cannot single out one group of health workers and accede to those demands. Then what of the midwives? What of the pharmacists?
What of the cleaners?
What of the other people? And then even when you get out of healthcare, what of the engineers? What of the architects? And so it's not as simple as it is. And somebody says, because doctors are special, give it to them. But others, it's not about 2,800 doctors. It's about another 5,900 and something who are waiting to see what the linkages are and say, okay, give doctors this, all right, we too are demanding this. And they can also go on strike.
But people are dying, Your Excellency.
We're taking remedial action. We're asking the doctors to go back. And I'm saying they should go back while we continue the negotiation. I think that's the only thing. Why hasn't government been serious with them? It's not like we're not paying their salaries. We're paying their salaries and we're paying their allowances. This is not about negotiating their salaries and allowances. This is about negotiating their conditions of service that has not existed before. This is not about their conditions of service that has not existed before. It's new. Your salaries are being paid. Your allowances are being paid as have been negotiated on the single strike. Additional duty hours. On some of those things, you're saying we should increase astronomically what you get. The government can give you what it has. We went to Parliament, we approved the budget, we said we're going to spend this amount on wages and salaries. If we go above that, and other agencies and other professions come and make their demands, and we go above what we budgeted for wages and salaries,
will end up for 2016, not really for 2015.
So why are you on strike now?
Because the budget will be prepared within 2015 and presented to Parliament.
The budget is going to be presented at the end of November. We're only in August. And so people must die until the budget is presented. It doesn't make sense. And the point is, yes, if negotiation takes place, and as I speak, negotiation on Category 2 and 3 allowances are taking place at the public joint negotiation team. And if they reach agreement, it will be factored into the budget for 2016. But nobody has gone on strike because of Category 2 and 3 allowances. And so why should we go on strike, you know, because of conditions of service? It's not like we're not paying your salaries. Every 25th you go, your salary is there, allowances. It's not the same in other countries.
There's a statement from the Labor Relations and Employment Ministry saying that they might not get paid at the end of this month if they don't return to work. You support that statement as the president of this country?
Well, if we don't live by our laws, we will go back to the jungle. There are laws governing things. And the law says that when you're negotiating and negotiation hasn't broken down, you don't strike. And that you don't negotiate under duress. That is all in the labor law.
Mm.
The labor law was passed by Parliament. It's law.
Mm.
And it also says that if you engage in an illegal strike, you don't get paid.
So you agree to the statement from the ministry?
The ILO recognizes that.
Mm.
And so in developed countries, labor unions have what they call strike funds. And so when they declare a strike, they pay their union members out of the strike funds. In Ghana, we haven't applied it, you know, as a humanitarian reason or something. But when you don't do that, then you don't create discipline in the system. So everybody gets up and declares an illegal strike.
So you agree to the statement.
And when that happens, we do have a difficulty.
Mm.
The Minister of Employment issued a statement, and he's going by the law that exists.
So you, the president, agree with what the law states. So you approve of that statement, that if you don't return to work, they will not get paid.
It is unnecessary interference in processes by the president that creates the kinds of problems that we have to come back and face.
Mm.
The Labour Minister is quoting the Labour Act, and he says that if you have an illegal strike, go back, because the Labour law says that you can't do this. And we expect that they'll go back to work.
Mm.
And we're still in negotiation. Last Sunday, our negotiating team met with the doctors, and I believe that they would meet again. And if they meet, I think that we should be able to resolve this. But in the meantime, they should go back to work while we continue the negotiation. I think that is fair to the people of Ghana.
Your Excellency, there's this perception out there, which sometimes people are forced to believe, that it is only strike. Strike is the only language that the government has.
It's a wrong perception. Absolutely wrong.
What makes it wrong, Your Excellency?
It's a wrong perception. Absolutely wrong.
Because if 91 doctors would decide to move to the offices of the Controller Accountant General Department because they've not been paid for 11 months, and the following 2-3 days and within a week they are paid, then they are hurt because they strike.
Let me explain something to you. For some, the processes that we need to go through in respect of how we handle human resource issues, this automatic posting system is not efficient. And so by the time returns come from the district to be inputted into the attorney, into the accountant general system, it takes a while. But aside from that, the accountant general is implementing reforms because of ghost names. And so the attorney general, the accountant general has put in a system that makes you not able to be paid if you don't have a social security number, because we're synchronizing the payroll with the social security system. And so you have doctors who don't have social security numbers, and so they have to go to SNIT and register and get social security numbers before accountant general can pay them. We need to smoothen all these out in order that, you know, we can have people paid on time. As I speak, there are some ministers who have not been paid because they have to go through the checks that
that makes sure that when they are inputted on the payroll, they really do exist and are where they are so that they can be paid.
Mm.
Unfortunately, because of these integrity issues and the reforms we are going through, it does happen that things like this occur.
So strike is not the only language that
government has. It's not the only language. Mm. It isn't the only language.
Mm.
And I think that misperception is what makes everybody declare a strike as soon as they have a grievance. I believe that if we go through the right procedures, we can...
If the demands are met when they declare strike, then it goes to strengthen that whole
community. Not all the doctors have been paid yet. Some of them are still going through the process. I know one young doctor who has only got her social security number last week and has sent it to the accountant general so that the pay can be given. Of those who went on strike, some of them preparation had reached an advanced stage, and so once it was done, it was paid to them. But there are others who are still fulfilling the process to be able to go. But we need to streamline all these so that we don't create these inconveniences to people.
Let me find out this from you, Your Excellency. Recently, we had reports that a doctor from Kolebu, obviously on strike, but was rushed to the 37 military hospital where the doctors there are not on strike, and the emergency surgery was performed on that doctor. You're taking on that piece of this, and my follow-up question will come.
Yeah, I heard about it, and I think that is instructive. If we go on an illegal strike, and you're a doctor, and you would run emergency services and outpatient services, your mother may be in the village in Bole, might have an emergency or be involved in an accident, and because doctors are on strike, she'll die. And so it's not just us, you know, who are not doctors who suffer. Doctors' own relatives and even doctors, like you said, you know, can suffer emergencies and die because doctors are on an illegal strike. And that's what I'm saying. They should go back to work. Government will negotiate in good faith. And what is due them will be paid to them. And so if the negotiation is successful and you're paid what is due you, are we going to go back and resurrect the people who died while we're on strike? They would have died. And that's why it's unfortunate. It's an essential service. And I believe that, you know, doctors should think about the welfare of Ghanaians.
This whole strike has revealed certain things to us in this country that we seriously need to improve on our health infrastructure. What's the level, what level have we got into in terms of our health infrastructure in this country so that we can just quickly address some of these challenges?
You need help.
George, this period has seen some of the heaviest investments in health infrastructure. We've spent in excess of $1 billion on health infrastructure alone. Regional hospitals, district hospitals, they are too numerous to mention. I mean, you can see the work going on at Reach Hospital, at Police Hospital. We're building a new university teaching hospital in Lagos. We re-equipped the whole of Kolebu Hospital and all the other teaching hospitals. We are expanding Tamale Hospital. We've done phase one. We're doing phase two. We're building the WA Hospital, a new military hospital in Kumasi, Fomena Hospital, Bekwai Hospital, you know, just name them, so many district hospitals. We built five polyclinics in Upper West Region, five polyclinics in Northern Region, five polyclinics in Bronga Hafu Region, five polyclinics in Western Region. We have got financing for five polyclinics in Greater Accra, 10 polyclinics in Central Region. I mean, the investment is phenomenal. Tepa Hospital is ongoing, Konongo Hospital, Soko, Bekwai. I mentioned the choir already. I mean, there are just so many of them that are taking place. And we're building also hundreds of CHIPS compounds, you know, in rural areas that are hard to reach. And we are stuffing them with professionals who can help to reduce maternal mortality and treat, you know, small ailments. So there's so much that is going on. We've opened new health professionals training schools, like nurses and midwifery training schools. We've opened 31 new ones. We've opened physician assistant training schools. This era has seen some of the largest investments in health facilities than any other period in our history.
The You're listening to Unique 95.7 MHz, and the program is a Unique Breakfast Drive. It's live for Unique 95.7 MHz. This morning, we're live at the residence of the President, His Excellency John Dramani Mahama. Today is International Youth Day, and we've spoken much more about the youth, and now we're moving into other areas too. So if you're just joining us, this is Unique FM, and you're at the right place. I promised you yesterday that we're going to have good breakfast today on the Unique Breakfast Drive. For that matter, we're at the President's house. Let's talk about security, your security. What did you make of the news a couple of weeks ago that a gentleman confessed in court that he came to church to kill you?
The BNI is investigating what happened, and I think that the people in charge of my security have taken measures following what happened to beef up, you know, the security around the president. But I didn't think much of it. God is my protector.
You're not scared?
No, I wasn't. I mean, my steps were guided here, and God is with me. I believe that He will protect me, and no harm shall come to me. No weapon fashioned against me shall prosper.
You think your life is not in danger?
For a person in the position I am, you take decisions that might not be palatable with everybody, and people have their different orientations and, you know, different motivations, and so you do your job, and there are risks that come with your job, and I do believe that, like I said, God guided my steps here, and He is my protector.
So that goes to support the dead goat syndrome thing, I guess.
You said that good. I haven't mentioned that.
I mean, you created that saying the way you went to Botswana. I mean, you developed that good.
I was using it to expatiate a point, you know, and it was taken out of context completely, and I'm a living goat.
You're a living goat, not a dead goat. Okay, I should continue to say that this interview is live on Star FM 103.5 Star. It's also live on City FM 97.3. It's live on Radio Gold 90.5. It's live on Joy FM 99.7. It's also live on Radio Gold 103.1. Live on Radio XYZ 93.1. Also live on Atinka FM 104.7. This is Unique FM 95.7 of the Ghana Broadcasting Corporation. This is the head of state and Duke of Enugu, best media organization for youth development in this country 2015. And we are coming away at the residency of the President, His Excellency John Dramani Mahama. Your Excellency, the end will be going shortly to its finals. And, well, you prepared for competition?
Yeah, sure. NDC is a very democratic party, and we allow for competition at all levels of appointments, and so we're prepared for any competition. That's why we're called the National Democratic Congress. Yeah.
So you're prepared for anybody to come out to compete you?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Nominations will be opened, and anybody can pick up nomination forms and contest. Yeah.
You have any special interest in terms of the candidates for the constituency elections for the party?
No.
Parliamentary?
No. I don't get involved, especially when it gets to parliamentary. I think that the people, our party supporters, should be left freely to choose. If you allow the process to take place without interference, they will choose who they think is best to represent them, and your chances at the main election are better. But if you interfere and muddy the waters, you might emerge with a candidate who would lose you the constituency. And so I believe in non-interference in the parliamentary primary.
Okay. You're sure that by the end of this year you're going to have the same power minister? As in,
he's your prime minister.
You're sure you're going to have the same prime minister by the end of this year? Looking at how things are developing.
I always remind him that his head is on the block. Because he openly declared that if by end of December he hadn't resolved the doom song, I should chop off his head. And so his head is on the block. But, of course, it's one of the ministries that I keep an eye on. And I get daily briefings on what happens. I know that they've taken the steps that would lead to the end of Dumsor.
Mm.
What is happening is that the days of cheap hydropower are over. Akosombo has served us very well. 1,020 megawatts. When we started, the whole of Ghana was using less than 100 megawatts.
Mm.
And so we had to sell some to Togo, and then Baku took the rest. And we had a huge redundancy. We have since exceeded Akosombo. We have exceeded Bui. We have exceeded Pong. And we still need more power. The only additional power we can bring is thermal, using gas, coal, and maybe light crude oil. But that is more expensive. Thermal power is 500 times more expensive than hydropower. And so as we transition to thermal, then it means that our tariff structure cannot remain the same as it was with hydro. What we are having to do with hydro now is to use hydro as a backup. And so we have emergency power coming. We have the car power ship, which I'm told is getting ready to sail anytime soon. In September it will come, and then it has to be, you know, connected to our transmission grid. We have the Ameri project, the civil works is almost being completed. And when it comes, that will give us another 250 megawatts. The car power ship will give us 225 megawatts. And then we signed up with AXA, which was approved in Parliament. That will give us another 370 megawatts. And then we have another project coming, the TEI. All these are emergency power plants. If you calculate the amount of emergency power we're putting, it's more than 1,000 megawatts. Aside from that, we're finishing the Kontema plant, which will give us another 220 megawatts. And Asogli has started phase two. 180 megawatts of Asogli will be ready by end of December. So if you look totally, we're looking at about 1,500 megawatts of thermal power that is coming in. So it means that over the last year or so into next year, we're going to put in more than Akosombo. Akosombo is 1,020 megawatts. Between now and next year, we're going to put in 1,500 megawatts of thermal power. So our tariffs will be more thermal based now than hydro based. And so we would see some increase in tariffs. But aside from that,
we are not abandoning hydro.
No, we're not. Hydro will become more of a backup. So it won't be our main power source now. It will rather be the backup. But thermal will be our main source of power. So we need to introduce efficiency into our power sector. That means that we must pay our bills. We need to put in more prepaid meters. You know, we must collect the revenues and make it more efficient. People must stop stealing power. Because when you steal power, you make it more expensive for all of us. People bypass meters and so on and so forth. If we all pay, the tariffs can come down. But if we don't pay and a few people are paying, then the tariffs go up and make it more expensive for all of us. So if you see somebody stealing power, stop him, because he is making your power more expensive, because he is stealing power. And those of us who are paying would have to pay what the cost of the power is. So I hope that ECG would be up on its brief and make sure that those who are stealing power are dealt with.
So we are sure that you're going to fix this power problem, as you've promised.
Yes. I think that the minister is on track. I'm giving him all the support.
But you said you will fix it.
Yeah, I'll fix it.
Okay.
But of course, I'm not sitting in the power ministry and doing it myself. I have somebody doing the job for me, and so I supervise, and we'll fix it.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about other areas too. We know you like Interior. You danced to that song some time ago when you were in the Ashanti region. Apart from Daddy Lumba, which other Ghanaian music artists are you so fond of?
I like a lot of the old artists. Of course, Korean Tree continues to be my favorite. And I like to listen. I like J.W. Ambule. I like K.K. Kabobo. You know, some of those.
What about the young ones, since at least today is International Youth Day?
I like the young ones too. I listen to some of the old young ones, like Sasha Mali and others, you know. I like Wuta, you know, I like VIP.
Wuta is no more.
Yeah, Wuta, they had their music was so.
VIP is now VVIP.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm.
But recently I listened to Stone Boy.
Mm.
Yeah. Shikina. I think he's got a good hit. With Shikina. Yeah. And then also Bafira.
Yeah. Okay.
That's also a good one. I like music, and so I listen to, you know, I like Ghanaian music.
Mm.
I listen to many of our artists.
Mm. In Kenya, my producer told me this morning that in Kenya, the local radio stations, the presenters said they are going on strike because it looks like there's too much foreign music that's being played on their radio stations. That is killing the local music industry.
Yeah.
What do you make of the Ghana music industry and how best we can enhance on it?
I think Ghanaians are taking to our music, and a lot of our young people are taking to our music. There's been an influx, invasion of Nigerian music too, but I think it's the same West African tradition. Competition is good, and so when the Nigerian music, you know, comes in, it kind of inspires and encourages our own artists to also up their game. And so I think that's good. We listen to a lot of Nigerian music and to Ghanaian music too. I don't think that in Ghana I don't listen to too much radio, especially outside the news program.
Mm.
But I do think that we must aim for a fair balance in terms of foreign music and local music.
Mm.
Foreign music is good. I have some favorite old artists, Barry White and others. I like to listen to it in my spare time.
Mm.
But it's a balance between foreign and local. I don't think we should overplay foreign music at the expense of our local music. But I know there's a broadcasting bill coming up which will specify, you know, what level of local content, you know, we must receive airplay on our local radio station.
What about movie industry?
Movie industry, I love Ghanaian movies. I like West African movies. I watch Nigerian movies. Some are very good. I watch Ghanaian movies. Some are very good. I like, you know, some of the films that Shelley Frimpomaa has produced. Yeah, she's an exceptional producer. Some of her films are wonderful. I watched Perfect Picture, you know, and then she's got this series, Devil is in the Detail. I also like the KJTR Hollywood, and I have some. I like Lil Wayne.
You like Lil Wayne?
No, he's funny. I like Lil Wayne. I like Ejako. You know.
Some people say they're too abusive in their movies.
I think they're getting there. You know, if you look at some of the very early movies, they were quite amateurish, but they're beginning to get their act together. And it's interesting. There's a lot of humor. You know, you have some quite serious actors: Bernard Nyako, Emilia Broby, and others. I mean, those are all. Of course, Chewa would always make you laugh. You know, and I think that they also have a good thing coming up with the other urban movies. You know, people like Jackie Appiah are doing very well. I like John Dumelo. I like it when he's acting. Yeah. When I travel, I try to take some Ghanaian movie CDs. So we don't watch any foreign CDs on the presidential jet.
When we travel?
Yeah, when we travel, we watch Ghanaian movies.
And we decide that?
Yeah, we carry a pack along.
Okay.
We get new movies, Ghanaian movies.
Sometimes
we have to fly for 7-8 hours, and you can't just sit, you know, doing nothing. And so we put Ghanaian movies and we watch. Yeah.
Okay, all right. The last time you were on Al Jazeera, you were asked the question whether if that movie that it's about to be produced about the black
man. What role I'll
which
play?
Which role you play? And you decided.
No,
including Denzel Washington.
He chose
Denzel Washington.
Yeah. No, he's a good actor. I love him. I like him.
Let's say if within our context here in Ghana, which actor would you choose to play?
I thought I gave that away. I said I like John Dumelo.
You like John Dumelo?
I think so.
Okay, all right.
If I had to choose.
If you had to choose.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And my final question, maybe last but not question though, the road infrastructure, we've seen lots of construction going on and reasphalting also going on. With that of the Nkrumah interchange, when are we expecting a complete work done?
It will be finished before the middle of next year. Completely.
Completely?
Yes.
Okay.
We've opened two of the bridges and they're working on the others, and then they're going to start mounting the third tier. Once that is done, they will start the landscaping around the circle, and then by middle of next year we'll open it. But we're doing other routes in Accra that, you know, a lot of people probably haven't noticed yet. We've finished the Gifford Road. Ghanaians like Accra, people in Accra like to call it Elwak Road, but that's the road from 37 through the Elwak Stadium, over the bridge to Bema Camp and then to Trade Fair. We finished that road, and then we've done a link through Bema Camp, the Air Force Station, to link the Sprintex Road. And then we're also doing another link behind Bema Camp to link Teshi. They call it the Teshi link. Now what we're trying to do is to improve the linkage between Accra East and the center of the city, so that you don't have just one road. You have, formerly they all had to take the Sprintex Road and come through Tete Kwasi into Accra, or come along the Teshi Beach Road into Accra. Those were the only options open to all those in the eastern part of Accra. Now that is going to change. You know, they can come through the Teshi Link, come behind the Makam onto the Elwak Road, or they can come from Sprintex through the Air Force Station onto the Elwak Road, or take the traditional polo court. We've done a diversion at the polo court, so they can come through there, through the airport into Accra. So it offers, what we're trying to do is to offer alternatives to motorists, so that we don't have the kind of congestion that we've had. We're doing the Awoshi-Pokwasi Road, so that people going from that part of Accra to the northern part don't have to come through Achimota. They just go through Awoshi-Pokwasi and join the Achimota Road. We started the Kaswa interchange, and part of the Kaswa interchange is 20 kilometers of roads in the Kaswa area, Ghana South area. And one of the roads we are targeting can take you from Kaswa to Pokwasi Street. So if you are in Kaswa and you want to go onto the Kumasi Road, instead of coming through Malam into Abeka and take the Achimota Road, you just cut across there and go straight onto the Achimota Road. So we're doing a lot of roads. I mean, I believe that one of the areas in which we have done massive investment is in road infrastructure. The cocoa roads alone is covering all the six cocoa growing regions, and work is ongoing. Town roads, highways, feeder roads, you know, we're working on the Eastern Corridor Road.
And are we monitoring to ensure that we get the quality of roads that we need?
Yes, our engineers are on top of it. We're making sure that the roads are of the right quality. What we've done is we've been careful in choosing the contractors who are engaged to make sure that they have the track record, you know. When we finish the Eastern Corridor Road, that will create a major, you know, entry point from 26 districts along the Eastern Corridor into Accra, Tema and Accra. Just last week, I commissioned the Solafofoso Road. That is a road that has existed from colonial times. My father walked on that road when he started primary school. They used to walk from Bole to Salaga to go to school. And like I said, he told me the story of when sometimes they met a pride of lions lying in the road, and they had to climb trees and sit in the trees till the lions went away before they continued walking. I mean, my father woke up today and saw that road. I mean, he would marvel that that is the same road that he walked when he was a child. So we are investing massively in the road sector, you know. And recently I cut the short to do Chebbi Town Roads. We're doing the road from Apedra through Chebbi to Bonso. We're doing the road from Koforidua to Bonso. We're doing the road from Suhum to Asamankese. I mean, there's so many, you know, too many to mention.
Let me get your final comments to our listeners and also those listening to us across the country.
I just ask Ghanaians to be patient. We're on track. Often when you watch a painter drawing a picture,
And so when he's almost finished, you can't tell exactly what he's doing. It looks chaotic at first. At some point, it looks chaotic. You think he doesn't know what he's about. But at the end of it, you see a very beautiful picture. What we're doing is we're drawing a picture on Ghana's canvas. It might look chaotic to some who don't know what the final picture would look like, but I can assure them that the final picture is going to be beautiful. We're investing heavily in our infrastructure. We're investing heavily in our human resource, and I believe that Ghana will be the better for it.
And the final picture will be at the end of 2016 where we see everything?
It will be like government get to a stage and it's continued as we go along. In 2016, people will begin to see part of that picture emerge, and in 2020, they'll see a very beautiful picture, and I believe that it will inure to the benefit of all Ghanaians.
Okay. Let me just address a few WhatsApp messages here. Mr. President says the strike of the doctors is illegal. What about the pharmacists and the university lecturers? And would you like to respond to this one?
I'm not the one who determines illegality. I think the Minister of Employment should do that. The Minister says the doctor strike is illegal. I know, I heard UTAG has gone on strike to do with book
research
allowances. I haven't been apprised of the detail of that particular issue. But I know that book and research allowances are paid once a year. And if the process is ongoing to make that payment, I know we're going to set up a research fund. And the research fund has not been set up yet, so it means that, you know, the lecturers are entitled to be paid their book and research allowances, and from what I hear, the process is ongoing to pay them, so I don't think that there's a need for a strike at this time. It's a one-off payment. It's paid once a year, and the year is not ended, and so I don't see why.
Maybe you're not saying that fast enough.
I think it's that same perception, that that's the only language government understands that you go on strike. Yeah. Yeah. But I think it's a wrong perception. It's unfortunate, you know, and we should discard it.
Big OK in Bantama, if the president talks of the strike being absolutely illegal, how about his office overspending beyond its budget? And this is coming from Big OK, who is listening to us in Bantama. We have another one too here. His Excellency, I'm very, very happy that you step up the youth enterprise support to see how best you can curb youth unemployment in the country. How would you enhance that this laudable program does not land in the hands of nation wreckers? I want to find out how you ensure that this whole program, that's the YES program, will not land in the hands of nation workers. Another one here is congratulations, Mr. President, redeeming a major campaign promise to the youth of Ghana. I, however, would humbly appeal to review the age limit. I would also like you to review the youth in agriculture policy for young people. And this one is coming from Jifa, who is listening to us in Gulu. Alhaji Alidu Haruna, this is truly a president for the people. He must be supported. Mr. President, your promotion on the strike, or your position on the strike and the striking doctors is on point, and you have shown in leadership. I have another one to hear coming from Musa, who is listening to us in Kumasi. In fact, the President has spoken well, not despite all these wonderful developments. How is government going to deal with public sector agitations and especially the outrageous demand by the Ghana Medical Association? I think that's it for the WhatsApp message we have. If you can report, respond to some of them. Yeah.
I've taken note of some of the issues. Somebody says that we should look at the age limit in respect of the YES program, so that, you know, more young people can come in. I don't know what the current age limit is, but I hear it's about 18 to 35 years. I think that if you go beyond 35, you might not exactly, you know, qualify for the target group that they are looking at. But if you are outside the bracket, there are other, you know, initiatives that are available to you. And so if he can get in touch, we can direct him to the Skills Development Fund or some other fund that can support him. So for those who are above 35 and don't qualify for yet, they can get support in other places. The Youth in Agriculture Program, I'm very sad. The coordinator, you know, died recently. And so we'll have to appoint a new coordinator, but we are revamping it with the Youth and Enterprise Agency bill that was passed in Parliament. And so for those who are interested in agriculture, youth in agriculture, yes, it's something that we're going to do. The Youth Enterprise Agency is going to create jobs for 100,000 young people, and we're targeting identifiable groups, like he said, youth and agriculture will be one of them. We're also fashioning something for the gender ministry to do with Kayaye, resettlement of Kayaye, and providing them with skills, and so they would also be recruited into the Youth Employment Agency program. So there's a lot of opportunity coming up there in the youth enterprise. He says, how would we deal with public sector agitation? We will continue to negotiate and discuss with public sector union leaders to understand that the economy is not for the president. It belongs to all of us, 25, 26 million people. If we make unnecessary demands, or if we make excessive demands, and we destabilize the economy again, all of us will suffer. We need to follow the spirit of the whole forum. We met in whole and we came to some agreements. We did a follow-up meeting in Takrade and we came up with some agreements. And let me say that most of our professional and labor unions are following the spirit of whole.